18-year-old kids, one sentence, what would you say to them? What's the restorative, the redemptive sentence? What should they do?
Don't be thinking your ambition is corrupt. You know, because that's part of the message now. Human beings, we're a cancer on the planet. We're headed for an environmental apocalypse. The entire historical structure is nothing but atrocity, etc., etc. Anyone with any ethical aim whatsoever is just going to pull back. You don't want to manifest any ambition, support the patriarchal structure, exploit the environment. You've got to crush yourself down. You shouldn't even have any children. It's like, no. There's no excuse for that. There's zero excuse for that. I saw a professor at an event, something like this. He came out and trumpeted this bloody environmentally friendly house he built. And, you know, fair enough, man. It was a pretty interesting house, but not everybody had the $4 million that it took him to build it. And I'm not criticizing his money even. It's like, he's had some money, good for him. He built a house, okay. But then to trumpet that as a moral virtue, well, you're pushing it there. And then he came out to all the kids and he said, you know, my wife and I decided that we were only going to have one child. And I think that's one of the most ethical things we could have possibly done. And I would strongly encourage you to do the same. I thought, you son of a you get up in front of these young people. A lot of these kids were children of first-generation immigrants from China. And he showed all these images, you know, of these terrible factories in China, these endless rows of sterile mechanism that were subordinating all the Chinese people to this terrible, you know, capitalist machine. And I thought, you don't understand, half the audience is looking at those factories and thinking, that's a hell of a lot better than struggling through the mud under Mao, buddy. And so I don't know where he thought he was, but to come out in front of all those kids and basically tell them that the whole human enterprise is so goddamn corrupt that the best thing they could possibly do is limit their multiplication, and to think of himself as a scholar and an educator. I did say something, by the way. It was rather uncomfortable, and he stomped off the stage. But that's no message for young people. There's no excuse for that. And you think, well, we're going to destroy the planet. We have to do this. We have to demoralize the youth to be ethical. It's like, yeah, really, that's your theory? You're going to demoralize young people to be ethical? That's your theory? It's like, you should go home and think about that for like a year. And I'm passionate about this, you know, because you have no idea how many people that's killing. You have no idea. I see people everywhere, all over the world, they're so demoralized, especially young people, with a conscience, because they've been told since they were little that there's nothing to them but corruption and power. It's like, how the hell do you expect them to react? If you orient yourself ethically in the most fundamental sense, then in some sense you have the force of God on your side, and then maybe you can prevail despite the difficulty. And I think that's right. I think that's true. So, and you can ask yourself, I try to ask these questions seriously, you know, and I would also say that I've been driven to my religious belief, such as it is, by necessity, not by desire. What do you want to have on your side when you're contending with the unknowable future and its vagaries? How about truth? How about beauty? How about justice? You want allies? Those are powerful allies. People have to, they have to act as ethically as they are powerful. And so I've been trying to convince people to do that, I suppose, or to put forward, not to convince them precisely, but to put forward an argument about why that's necessary and why it's on them. It's like, no, this is on you. You got to understand this problem, it's you. You don't get it right, it isn't going to work. And so how do you do that? Well, you start with what you have under control in your own life, because where else are you going to start? You look to yourself, put your house in order. Don't be worried about some other person walking the satanic path. And that's what activists do all the time, right? It's you. It's the corporations. Like, it's someone else. No, no. It's you. And I think that's also fundamental to the Judeo-Christian doctrine, is that it's you. It's on you. Redemption's an individual matter. And so my hope is that if enough people take themselves with enough seriousness, then we won't end up in hell. Because we certainly could. It's a high probability. And I also don't think that you can be motivated enough to put your house in order to the degree that's necessary merely by being attracted, let's say, to the potential utopia that might emerge as a consequence of that. So that'd be a vision of heaven, let's say. No, you need to also be terrified of hell. Think, well, there's no such thing. It's like, just because you haven't been there doesn't mean there's no such thing. It's like, you have to be pretty bloody naive to think there's no such thing. Like, how much evidence do you need? And how does it come about? Well, it comes about at least in partial consequence of the sins of men. And I think that's true. So I go around and I talk to people. I say, look, there's not only more to you than you know. There's more to you than you can imagine. You have an ethical responsibility to act in that light. And you might claim not to believe that, but I would say, well, your whole culture is predicated on that belief, and insofar as you are an active member of that culture and a believer in its structure, then you believe it. You might not be very good at believing it, you might be full of conflict and doubt, and you might not be able to articulate it, but it's still right at the bedrock of your culture, this notion of what? The divine sovereign individual. Is that not what your culture is predicated on, that idea? The logos inherent in each person, it's something other than that? I've never seen a credible argument made to show that it's anything other than that. You know, you can say, well, rights are attributed to you by the state. It's like, sorry, that's a weak argument because the state's dependent on your actions. So, you know, to believe that, you have to believe that the state is the entity and that individuals are just subordinate in some fundamental sense to the state. It's like, no. The state is dependent on the individual to exactly the same degree. So, we're the active agent of the state, in some sense. We're the seeing eye of the state, the speaking mouth of the state, because the state's dead without the individuals that compose it.
C.S. Lewis, if I swallow the scientific cosmology as a whole, meaning only all that exists is what we can perceive through our senses, then not only can I not fit in religion, I cannot even fit in science. If minds are wholly dependent on brains, and brains on biochemistry, and biochemistry in the long run on the meaningless flux of the atoms, I cannot understand how the thought of minds should have any more significance than the sound of the wind in the trees. You feel that one as well.
Yeah, well, that's a complicated problem, that. First of all, I do believe that I don't think science is possible outside of an encompassing Judeo-Christian ethic. So, for example, I don't think you can be a scientist without believing as an axiom of faith that truth will set you free or that will set us free. So we don't know the conditions under which science is possible, you know, and we tend to overestimate its epistemological potency. It's only been around, I mean, you can stretch it back to the Greeks if you're inclined, but in a formal sense, it's only been around for about 5 centuries, and it's only thrived for a very short period of time, and it's perfectly reasonable to assume that there were particular preconditions that made its rise and ascendancy possible.
It is a historical phenomenon.
Yes.
It happened at a specific moment in time.
Right, and for and at least
so
in
you
principle
say, what are the
for
conditions?
Particular reasons. Yeah,
Got
and I think one of the conditions, well, there's a bunch of them. One is, for example, there's an intense insistence in the Christian tradition that the mind of God, in some sense, is knowable.
Yes.
So we could say, well, the structure of the cosmos, and you have to believe that that's the case before you're going to embark on a scientific endeavor. You have to believe that there's some relationship between logos, logic, let's say, but logos is a much broader concept than logic, that's for sure. You have to believe that there's some relationship between that and the structure of the cosmos. You have to believe that the pursuit of truth is in itself an ethical good, because why would you otherwise bother? You have to believe that there is such a thing as an ethical good. And those are not scientific questions, which is why I think the arguments of people like Hitchens are weak. It's like, yeah, Hitchens, Dawkins, people like that, they have a metaphysic, which they don't know. And they assume that metaphysic is self-evident. It's like, well, sorry guys, it's actually not self-evident. And they assume that it can be derived from the observations of empirical reality, and the answer to that is no, there's going to be axioms of your perceptual system that aren't derivable from the contents of your perceptual system. And you might think, well, that's not very scientific, and I would say, well, take it up with Roger Penrose and see what he thinks. Because I just talked to him for like 3 hours about this topic, about, say, the role of consciousness and the structure of consciousness, and it's by no means obvious that the materialist reductionists have the correct theory about the nature of consciousness. And not surprisingly, it's like we don't understand the relationship between consciousness and being at all.